Welcome to Preaching Podcasts. For those who proclaim publicly, this is a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry in the Diocese of Central Pennsylvania in the U.S., where we take a look at the lectionary from diverse and unique perspectives to better prepare church worshipers, educators, leaders, pundits, proclaimers for Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and with me today is Althea Spencer-Miller and Josh Davis. Hello.
Hello, Deirdre. Hello, Josh.
Hello,
listening folks.
Wonderful to be with you both again. Thanks to the miracles of technology, I always think we should give thanks to God when we're able to do this, and it keeps going. We are today discussing readings for the Sunday closest to August the 3rd, Proper 13, Year A, in the cycles of Pentecost. Track 1 continues the saga of Jacob in a passage from Genesis 32, in which he is sending ahead of him most of his retinue because he's nervous about meeting his brother Esau again. So we don't dwell on that so much as what happens when Jacob has sent everything ahead and he's left alone, and in the night he is engaged in a wrestling match with someone. And this mysterious someone turns out to have something to do with God. The gospel, just to jump from one end to the other, the gospel in track A is the passage in Matthew 14. 5,000 people are fed with nothing but 5 loaves and 2 fish. It's a great feeding narrative in Matthew's gospel. It's in chapter 14. And it follows along Matthew 13. We've been following that with the parables. And Matthew 14 is the demonstration of the superabundance of God's kingdom. The track 2 follows Isaiah 55, which is the invitation to come to the waters of 3rd Isaiah. Come by and eat, come by wine and milk. Incline your ear and listen to God. I will make with you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David. So it's a different track completely. The psalm in track 1 is Psalm 17. And that is a psalm about an innocent psalmist or an individual crying to God for vindication in verse 2, justification in verse 5, my footsteps hold fast to the ways of your law. Show me your marvelous, verse 7, loving kindness. This is something we've been tracking a little bit. The Romans passage is the same, whether in track A or track B, and it's Romans 9. It's Paul. He's talking about his own experience of his kinspeople being separated temporarily by some mysterious process from the thing that connects them to God, namely through the law, the worship, and the promises. He has great anguish because of the short period of time that divides Jews from connections to God in order that Gentiles may come in, non-Jews. And this is the point of writing the letter to the Romans. So it's a very elliptical passage, but we see Paul in the first person singular. Now, I do not know quite, I'll confess, how to connect this all to the collect, which is a plea for mercy. We see this in the psalm, to mercy so that the church, the assembly, may be cleansed and defended by God. And it needs God's help to continue in safety. It needs God's governance in order to continue in goodness. But how to connect that collect to each of the readings is a mysterious thing. It's not a bad thing to pray for the church, of course, but I can think of other passages that might relate more directly to assemblies of people. So there we are. What shall we pick up, my friends?
I wasn't so sure about Romans 9, 1 to 5.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear what you say about the collect, and I found it perplexing also how to connect it. Usually there's such a clear, there are points where there are clear thematic connections between the collect and the readings. But without an assumption of the church subsuming the history of Israel, it's, and God's protection for those people in that covenant, it's difficult to see a clear connection. But then I think about Romans 9, 1 to 5 and our discussion of the ending of Romans chapter 8 and the idea that there is nothing that can separate you from the love of God, which is ours in Christ Jesus. The theme of separateness, if I break up the assumption, and I'm sort of emphasizing what you were saying, Deirdre, and meditating upon what you were saying about Paul's agony in Romans 9, 1 to 5, that speaking to a community that has both Gentiles and Jews in it, there is nothing that can separate the people of that community from the love of God, which is a love that has gone on for the entirety of the history of Israel and now is being enjoined by Gentiles. Nothing can separate you from that love because of Christ Jesus. Then we get into Romans 9, 1 to 5, which goes through, I think, at least chapter 11, a place where he's just agonizing about the meaning of this new covenant for the continuity of Israel in the covenant itself. And how does he, if he's doing that here, conceive of nothing separating you from the love of God when it seems there is going to be anxiety, a deep concern in Paul for whether or not this new thing in Christ can legitimately or reasonably be argued as separating the people of the original covenant from this new covenant.
Yep.
I just see Romans 9, 1 to 5 as the beginning of that concern.
Yep. I mean, I haven't looked at next week's readings, but it may be that it continues Romans 9, which would be a very helpful thing, since, as you point out, it's going to be something that Paul is wrestling with for at least two chapters, Romans 9 to 11. So, and at some point, very soon after verse 5, he simply says things like, God says, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, which is not explanatory, but descriptive. And then, as it is written, I have loved Jacob, but I have hated Esau. Well, thanks a lot. Then he wrestles with, is there injustice? You know, I mean, yeah. So we are introduced to this.
That's where I went with that one. Think about that.
I think the connection between the Genesis passage and the Romans passage is worth pointing out, just because of that Jacob and Esau reference. And as I think we've mentioned before, in the past, that it's very interesting in relationship to Romans 9, because this passage has been read traditionally as about, you know, the idea of election and predestination, you know, Esau representing those who are reprobate or who God has rejected for salvation, and Jacob representing those that God elects for salvation. But both in the Genesis passage and in Romans 9, nobody's left behind. the whole point of Romans 9 is that it may appear this way, but in fact, it is God's promise that will triumph in the end, or I may be having difficulty understanding exactly how this is all going to work out, but I don't doubt that God will remain faithful to the covenant. And in the Jacob and Esau passage, it's so interesting that this happens as he's preparing to go back, because he's tricked his brother out of the birthright, and his brother has in the meantime become an enormous nation in himself, and now he's got to go back and and confront him. And it's in that night that he wrestles with this person. And then his brother receives him and forgives him, apparently. So anyway, the Jacob and Esau thing may not be what it's always been read as being, I guess, is my point.
So I'm not quite following your point, Josh. I mean, I understand the reference in Romans 9 to Jacob I loved and Esau I hated. But how should we view the wrestling vis-a-vis the reconciliation?
Oh, I think what I was driving at is that I think that there's a presentation of Jacob as he's not such a good guy,
right?
And I was suggesting that there's a sense in which he's whatever it is that he's wrestling with here, it's with his own maliciousness. It's with his own, he's a bit like an Odysseus figure in the sense that, like, he's good at lying. He's good at tricking people. He's good at these things, but these things are not ultimately compatible with coming home and becoming who you are. Mm-hmm. And he may have come away with the birthright that he stole from his brother, but now at this pivotal point in his life, he's now got to come face to face with his brother. How is his brother? It's clear that his brother can rout him and his family at this point if he so chooses. How will he respond? And he responds with mercy to his brother. But in the meantime, before all of that happens, that's when Jacob has this moment, and he has to walk away from it limping, mm-hmm. having something. Mm-hmm. He's no longer whole in the same way, and mm-hmm. his name has changed.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that's is a really rich. I think this passage is oftentimes sort of read in an allegorical sense of, like, you know, universal validity of all of us struggling and wrestling with God or mm-hmm. something like that. And I think that's not irrelevant, but the context within which this happens is very important for how to interpret it. And because mm-hmm. I think it has something to do with, and I believe in our previous conversations about it, when we mentioned it just briefly, I was talking about how this also has something to do with Israel's own self-understanding as a nation and its relationship to those that are not in that, in that relationship or whatever. But this would define that relationship as one of struggle, first of all, with God.
Yep.
And one from which others are not necessarily excluded. And because from Edom, salvation will come at different points in both the prophets and the Psalms. But then I was taking that and bringing it to bear upon the way Romans 9 has been read in many ways as this clear division between inside and outside, which even I think if you read the Jacob passage or this Jacob event closely, doesn't allow you to come away with feeling entirely confident about at least your moral status, over against those that are that you from whom you distinguish yourself, I mm-hmm. suppose. Mm-hmm. It may be from them that you receive the gift that God wants to give you or something like that.
You touched some points, Josh. And
thanks.
Yeah, and that is, yes, thanks. And then that too. The one I wanted to latch onto for a moment, I'm not quite remembering how you put it, but it's the idea of Israel wrestling
mm-hmm.
with their own morality information. Jacob, not just becoming a founding father along with all his practices of chicanery, but you're suggesting that he might have been wrestling with himself, his own conscience, and the way he has been. So he moves on in Genesis 32 with anxiety about what it means to meet Esau.
Mm-hmm.
And Esau is the one who actually enacts the separation, even as he greets Jacob, although he greets Jacob with welcome. When Jacob suggests that they travel on together, it is Esau who says, I think, let's not. And they separate. So a people struggling with their founding, struggling with their origins and their beginnings, and wrestling also with where that history has taken them, and the ill that has befallen and the good that has come, you know, not only might straighten out Jacob a little bit in this narrative, but also explain how they came to be selected. It's part of the explanation of how they came to be selected. Why us, not Esau?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, and maybe not very clearly, but thinking about the way in which this theme of belonging and not belonging accompanies them through all the millennia right into the time of Jesus. And Paul wrestling with this same issue, because clearly if you have a narrative of election, you also have a narrative of rejection. So that both are possibilities. And along the way, as Paul goes on to say in that same Romans 9, not all Israelites are true Israelites. So there's also that tension of who belongs and who doesn't. What are the terms of their belonging? And so I'm sort of bringing all of that and folding it into Paul's agony. This new thing in Jesus Christ, what does it mean for my people? Mm-hmm. Who are the people of heritage, are the people of covenant? And to sort of truncate what I'm saying and attempt to give it a fine point. If we latch on to the questions of belonging and not belonging, how expansive is the covenant? Who in this Christ story, which peoples in this Christ story get to belong and who are excluded? I just wonder how that tension, that question, continues to hang over us as the inheritors of a very complex Christian history, but also how it erupts in the secular sphere, in the travails that the United States goes through at this point in history too.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Very helpful.
And what do we live inside of? You know, history has given us one answer, which I'm going to roughly connect to the collect. History has given us one answer. The way we as Christians have practiced it, it's that however Paul agonized, those who are followers of Christ are the true inheritors of the Jewish covenant. I shiver when I say that, but that's how we have sort of proceeded in the history of Western Christianity. But do we? How does this narrative of Paul's agony about the relationship with Judaism between Jews and Gentiles, do we inhabit the answer of the Christian, Western Christian ages, or do we inhabit the agony?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's both agony in the wrestling and the articulation of Paul in Romans 9. And there is this, I'm going to just call it simplistic description of the place where Jacob wrestles. now named as a place where Jacob has seen God face to face. So you get both the wrestling and the agony and the simple seeing. And the etymology of Israel is connected to both seeing and wrestling in this passage. But your point is quite right, Althea, that the wrestling that we see has been subordinated in the Pauline passage and perhaps even in the Genesis passage. because by the time we get to Romans 11, it's become a mystery. It's a mystery that some hardening has come upon the heart of Israel.
You know, if I did a superficial schematizing of Jewish history, and honestly, I tremble at my own temerity to even think I can do that. But when I think about it, in perhaps superficially, but with a hope that it could be probed and deepened, the scheme of Jewish history, it's never been, it's not pure biblically. There's a commingling with the Canaanites. The Ammonites have a say in it. The Moabites have a part in the construction of Israel. The original people coming out of Egypt were a motley collection.
Yep.
So there's a kind of seething restlessness in how do you form, create cohesion, develop the kinds of, and hold to the kinds of symbols and ideologies of belonging that Paul names in Romans, while at the same time having this kind of seething expansiveness, expand, contract, retract, expand, you know, that defines a people rather than rigid borders. In a sense, it has to be for followers of Jesus to be grafted into the covenant, as Paul talks about, I think, in chapter 11, for us to be grafted into the covenant, you know, the covenant has to have a notion implicit in its DNA of expansive inclusion. And wrestling with how to make it all work. And then what happens to the people who have been faithful in tradition all this time? Do we just displace them, run them over? You know, and perhaps I'm enamored with my own imagination at this point in time, but it's as if that is where we are in the United States in so many pockets and in the mega history of the country.
Yep.
You know, the symbols, the signs of belonging, the recovering from a history of ethnic amalgamations that hasn't quite worked yet. But we still have to wrestle with this. You know, and it's into that the church itself falls.
On my desk at the moment is a paperback book that came in the mail yesterday by a great Jewish scholar, Adele Reinhartz. Cast Out of the Covenant, which is her last book on Jews and anti-Judaism in the Gospel of John. I think she thinks she's retired. This is going to be it. But I'm looking forward to reading it. It's been out for a while, so it's not new. But what we do with the underside, you know, the underside of the Gospel of John with regard to Jews, is another angle on the same question. And it's I don't think I'm gonna solve it. I think wrestling with it and living it out in attempts to take Jewish contributions to Second Temple Judaism, including the New Testament, very seriously. This is the choice I've made.
Yes, me too.
Yeah, you too, exactly.
Yeah, hence my concern about my temerity.
Exactly. And that helps me then get a perspective on on what's going on politically as well.
You said to take Jewish contributions to...
to interpreting Second Temple literature, including the New Testament.
Right.
Very seriously. In other words, you know, Adele Reinhartz has written on the Gospel of John for decades. And now comes the book Cast Out of the Covenant. Do you see? So for a while, she was wrestling to see how it could be, how you could give the Gospel of John an inclusive, even pro-Jewish reading. But she can't do that anymore. So it's been a long, long journey, and this is the end result. So what we're going to then say is that this is not a topic for today's lectionary readings, but if it's the case that a modern Jewish person can write this about the Gospel of John, then we have to wrestle with a gospel that excludes, a gospel whose Christology excludes. That's a serious question.
And it had to be tumultuous in Paul's time, and tumultuous in him. And I think this is while I remember only in part Daniel Boyerin, who sort of introduced me into this, to his writings on Paul, introduced me into this discussion. It had to be a kind of acute sensitivity that we have lost in our Christian supersessionism, an acute sensitivity that there remains this problematic reality that has had political factors, economic factors, plain cultural factors, and the church's embroilment in these that have helped us to come to a very hardened place ourselves, Judaism is concerned, such that we forget. And I remember, I have seen the record. I am not that old, but I've seen books in the 1950s, going up to the 1960s, where Jews and Christians were in such deep conversation around biblical matters, precisely because of the Christian role in endorsing the Holocaust and the ways in which the Holocaust revealed the tensions, and that's such a simplistic word to use, but reveal the tensions between Christians and Jews during that period, and that there is a relationship to be repaired and a work to be done. And so I'm sort of perhaps resting in that place where Paul's agony, as you intimated, the agony might even be the place where God is revealed, rather than in the history of a particular hardened solution. But the agonizing over this is a place to sort of hang out for a little bit.
I want to say something about the gospel, and I think I can tie it in this way. So in the opening lines of the gospel, the verb to withdraw describes the action of Jesus in response to something unstated. Now, when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a deserted place by himself. So what is it that he's heard? So you have to dig back into Matthew 14, and you find that what he's heard is the death of John the Baptist at the hands of Herod's servants. This is an alarming, shocking, agonizing experience for Jesus to hear, because Jesus and John the Baptist are so closely connected in apocalyptic prophetic messages and proclamations of God's kingdom. So here's Herod's overtly aggressive action against followers of John, and perhaps by definition, disciples of Jesus. It's John's disciples who take John's body and bury it. And it's in response to that that Jesus withdraws. So rather than wrestle or see, just to use those verbs of Genesis, Jesus withdraws. and instead takes himself to a deserted place alone in a boat. And into that deserted place come crowds following him on foot. And when he gets ashore from the boat, we don't know more about what's been going on in the boat, but he sees a great crowd and has compassion for them. Now, that movement of withdrawal in response to hostility, I've written about and other people have written too. It's a pattern in Matthew's gospel. And it starts with Joseph, Jesus' adoptive father. Joseph has decided to divorce his wife because she's already pregnant. His engaged wife, Mary, his engaged spouse, fiancé, Mary, whatever, however ancient first century people described engagement, betrothal. And instead of that, the angel says, no, you can't separate from her at all. You've got to save the life of the child and his mother. And so Joseph withdraws to Egypt. And so begins the cycle of not resisting or avoiding difficulties, but following the direction of God to leave the hostility, the danger, the public embarrassment, the humiliation, the shame of Mary's state, and John the Baptist beheading. And off Joseph goes into Egypt and rescues the child and his mother. And off Jesus goes into a deserted place. And in that deserted place in our gospel comes the feeding of the 5,000. From nothing, from so little. So this is a third mode of behavior that we can encourage people who might be preaching or teaching on the gospel to reflect upon as a way that is a third option for hostile acts. And it may be that in that third option of avoiding direct confrontation comes some kind of blessing.
If I heard this, I would want to withdraw too.
Yeah.
Well, what is true is that you can't, if these things are true about these deeply embedded hostilities, biases, prejudices, then they certainly can't be wished away. Right. Yep. Or just denied. They have to be confronted directly and wrestled with and overcome in by looking at them with honesty. So.
You know what? I'm thinking in the narrative, inside the narrative world, something that I'd never noticed before, but I'm noticing it now. I'm thinking also with strategies of response. Verse 13, Jesus is not the only person who hears about the beheading of John the Baptist. The crowds hear it too. You know, when the crowds heard it, now I'm not sure what the crowds heard, whether they heard that Jesus had withdrawn or they heard the narrative about the beheading of John the Baptist. It's a little ambiguous, I think, in verse 13.
Yep.
And I could reduce that to the attractiveness of Jesus. But what it facilitates, if I continue thinking that the crowds heard this narrative, and you know, I think I'm thinking with an island imagination though, that something like this happened, everybody knows. It's not a secret. It didn't happen in private, because somebody worked inside that place and went home and talked to everybody about it, and people get to know. You know, so I can't imagine that it's only Jesus is withdrawing that the crowd heard about. I have to think of it as a both and kind of thing. They heard he left and they knew why he left. So if I continued in that vein, their following him is a choice they have made as to whose side to be on or who to commiserate with. At a time like this. And it might not be. I'm wondering if we could get away with thinking of it as not altogether innocent, but the kind of respite you need when you have You've been in the face of incredible brutality, mm-hmm. but you're going to regroup. You're going to regroup. You know your vulnerability. And if this can happen to someone who is as popular as John the Baptist, then what about Joe down the road?
Mm.
You know, what can happen to that person? So you regroup, and you regroup around 5 loaves and 2 fish.
Mm.
And the story becomes really huge because 5,000 people get fed by 5 loaves and 2 fish. The competence of Jesus as an alternative to the empire, the competence of a feast that can feed 5,000 people is certainly in contrast to a feast that ends up beheading a popular figure. You know, so
yes,
what is God providing in this story?
Very, very helpful. Very helpful.
The question I have is, we can completely spiritualize these passages. We haven't done that, but it can be done that way. And so we focus on the miracle. But I wonder if in hearing about the capacity of God repeatedly to have a people survive from Jacob all the way to Paul, wrestling with questions of belonging, and still they survive. And then in the presence of empire, imperial cruelty and nastiness,
mm-hmm.
you know, people find a way to enact miracles or someone who can do miracles for them. Are these passages just innocent? Or are they passages for a time like this?
Mm-hmm. Well, these are great suggestions and serious issues on which to reflect and teach and preach. Maybe this is a point at which to stop. Josh, do you have anything else you want to pick up?
Well, I suppose the one thing that I've been thinking about as this conversation has progressed is how there's a kind of, and I'm trying to figure out exactly how to phrase this, is that if we take the question of anti-Judaism seriously, and it's been a recurring theme of our podcast at different points, and mm-hmm. and the questions that you've raised about Adele Reinhardt's reading of John, and I was also, when you brought that up, thinking back on to Joel Marcus's retirement lecture, which deals with some of these questions. Joel Marcus himself, a Christian, but also a Jew as well, and a scholar written on the Gospel of Mark, mm-hmm. Talking about this parting of the ways, and talking about there being there most likely John having some connection of the Jewish the Jewish followers of Jesus in John's community, having been expelled from the synagogue. So there being that being a part of this, and from what I've gathered about Reinhardt's thesis, she's suggesting that adds to the complexity of what's happening on the Christian side of this in the gospel. And perhaps ironically, it was striking to me that there's a sense in which the insistence on inclusion may be, you know, surreptitiously, and I'm saying it with a sense of the irony involved, the constant looking for expansiveness and inclusion within Christianity may itself be colluding with anti-Judaism in that regard. Because it's precisely the expansion of the covenant to the Gentiles that is the inclusive argument. And if we are to wrestle with this, then I think we need to think through the complexities of that as well. I don't know if I'm making that entirely clear, but it was something that began to dawn on me as our conversation proceeded. Because and it may not be exactly correct to say that the conflict between Christianity and Judaism, although they weren't called Christians and Jews at this point, distinct from one another, is one that arises out of an argument for greater inclusion on the Christian side and a greater delimitation of a community on the Jewish side, then that argument or that discussion itself is one that we need to wrestle with in the context of our relationship to Judaism. And that can be, that would make it even more complex and difficult.
Yes. All right. I'm going to leave it there because that's both opening it up and challenging at the same time. Well, I feel very fortunate that we'll be able to go on having these discussions and that we are just making suggestions and sharing ideas about responses to these issues that arise and others out of the readings for today's lectionary choices. And I look forward to the next time we all meet, and I want to thank Althea and Josh for your great contributions, and I hope you stay well, and I hope everybody else stays well until the next time.
Bye, everyone.
Goodbye,
everyone.
Bye-bye.